Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I do have another comment that I would like to read for you before we get into today's program. And this is from the great country of Canada. It says, "Hello, JBL. I have been enjoying your series on Winston Churchill and wanted to respond to your request for feedback." Thank you, I want to say to that. So anybody out there, if you like these programs, please write in like this person did. "I recently came upon a quote you might like." Now, she goes on to say the quote is from Margaret Fuller. She was an American writer, journalist, and philosopher. She died young, together with her husband and daughter, in a shipwreck returning from Italy to America. Here's a quote from Margaret Fuller. "Today a reader, tomorrow a leader." I find it interesting that she also said, "I know all the people worth knowing in America, and I find no intellect comparable to my own." So anyway, if you are a reader, your chances of being a leader are greatly increased. So I'd like to hear when people talk about reading. Well, in our last program, we started to talk about how Winston Churchill began to came out of his wilderness years. And so he may have been out of the scene politically, but he was very definitely into the world scene, and he really understood what was happening with Germany. And of course, through most of the 30s and up until 1940, he was working very hard to get the nation to listen to them. And, very few, especially in the government, really listened to him. I mean, at that time, if you remember, Baldwin and Chamberlain spoke of a policy of appeasement. They were willing, to work with the Germans, essentially to have them be a shield against communism. And we know that was just not right. What a lot of people don't know at that time is Churchill, even though he was a Chartwell, he was being provided, really at great risk to himself, confidential information about the size of the British military establishment. And the figures were irrefutable that the German Air Force was far larger than the British Air Force. And even some of the treaties from World War I, said that the German, if they had an Air Force or if they had an army, it could not exceed a certain level. But the German Air Force was getting larger all the time. And this put England at a great disadvantage. Now, the other government leaders knew this. I mean, Churchill shouldn't have gotten the information, but Baldwin did nothing about it. In 1936, Churchill did get mixed up with the cause of Edward VIII, and he wanted to marry Wallace Simpson, and for that reason, it really did hurt his reputation at that time. But here, as all this is happening, in 1938, Germany annexed Austria. I mean, Churchill wanted to protest this, but even the newspapers wouldn't let him put any article about Germany annexing Austria. Even the British Broadcasting Corporation would not allow him to broadcast his views anymore. So it was really, getting really to the point where, I mean, he was being censored. In September 1938, Britain and France agreed to Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia at the Munich Agreement. And Chamberlain came back and said, "This is peace in our time." But I mean, Churchill was appalled at what they'd done to Czechoslovakia. I mean, they were starting to divide up. They were giving territory. And you know that even, we've said for years, even the state of Israel, they're giving up territory to get peace, and they're not going to get peace. And they did not get peace for doing that. Churchill was incensed. He felt they betrayed Czechoslovakia. And then he knew, and he said, because of Czechoslovakia, Britain would not escape from Hitler's ambitions. And he said that Britain really needed to come back and regain, well, its love of empire, regain its moral vigor. It really needed to get itself armed again. And, those cries went unnoticed. But here's the point, is Churchill's prophecies proved true. And essentially, by 1939, Britain and France found themselves utterly unprepared for the total war that was going to be waged by an invincible Nazi war machine. I mean, it was terrifying. It was absolutely traumatic, what was about to happen. The leaders in Britain, and including the king, thought the only hope for Britain lay in negotiated peace with Germany. I mean, this was crazy thinking. And this was unthinkable to Churchill, that you would give up your freedom and, connect yourself with a German, an evil German warlord is essentially what was going on. Now, the thing is, what we know is that by 1939, people in the government in England began to realize that they needed to bring Churchill back into politics to help them with this problem. It was an amazing, amazing situation. Here's what really precipitated this. I'm going to read to you from page 36 of Manchester. And again, these are things that, again, Paul Johnson can't cover everything. He's trying to cover just a short biography. But there's a lot of details of what was going on in Britain at this time, and also what was going on, in Germany. And Hitler, he was going to take as long as the people in Britain wanted the peace, or they wanted appeasement, he was going to take advantage of it. And, everybody was saying, oh, he's, we can work with Hitler, we can do this, we can do that. But I'll tell you what, they finally had their wake-up call. And this is what Manchester says at the top of page 36. He says, finally, at the end of the decade, after 6 years of preparation, he was ready. He's talking about Hitler. At dawn on Friday, September 1st, 1939, he sent 56 Wehrmacht divisions roaring eastward into Poland. Now London and Paris had no choice. They were bound to Warsaw by military alliances. They had to declare war, and reluctantly they did. And so that's really, in some ways, really kind of tragic. They were, Hitler was just going to keep moving forward. And they finally, instead of listening to Winston Churchill for 10 years, it was, this heinous act by Hitler taking Poland that actually got them into, declaring war. And it's because of the pacts, the treaties from World War I that said if one of them's attacked, they have to protect the other ones. And so that's what really got them into it. Now, if we're really honest, it was the policies of Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain that had left Britain unprepared for war with Germany. I mean, Hitler was already breaking promises. In March 1939, Hitler broke his promise that he made at the conference in Munich, and he seized the rest of Czechoslovakia. So not only did they give him the Sudetenland, but by March of 1939, he took the whole thing. I mean, this was really treacherous, and that's what began to shift the mood in Parliament. Churchill had urged an alliance with the Soviet Union, but Chamberlain rejected this idea and pushed Britain into an alliance with Poland. Stalin then turned where he could and made a fateful alliance with Hitler. We're going to see some of these things repeat themselves even in our time. Now, what this did is this opened the way for Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939. Then, of course, Britain and France had to declare war on Germany. And then, all of a sudden, once there's war, people in the government began to realize, well, how can Chamberlain lead a country into war? He's a pacifist. He wanted this negotiated peace. And so you know, they couldn't do it. They knew they could not rely on Neville Chamberlain. And so there was all of a sudden the move, let's bring back the first Lord of the Admiralty, which was Winston Churchill. Now, the point is, what's really tragic, even at this time, when Hitler went to take Poland, actually Britain and France did nothing to defend Poland. And so again, it's they weren't even keeping their commitments. And the reason why they didn't do anything to defend Poland is they really didn't have much to defend them with. And, you know, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, everything in Britain was really, it had been almost allowed to be downsized or degenerated. Then what really began to set things off is, you know, Germany decided to go and take offensive maneuver on Denmark and Norway. Now, it's really interesting. I'm going to read to you a little bit from Manchester. That spring of 1940 was probably one of the most beautiful ever in Britain. And here's what he says on page 37. I mean, it's if you understand what happened in September 1939, everybody was shocked that Hitler went into Poland. But then all of a sudden things went quiet. And there's even, at that time, they even called it the phony war. They didn't really believe a war was going to happen. Chamberlain was convinced and Baldwin was convinced that they could go in and kind of smash the Germans by that summer if they had to. And so, again, everything seemed to be quiet. And what people don't realize is the reason why it was quiet is it was such a bad winter that Hitler couldn't make any moves. And here's what Manchester says. This is, afterward, everyone remembered the weather. The winter of 1939 to 1940 had been a white horror, Europe's cruelest since 1895, and though neither Paris nor London knew it, the only reason Hitler hadn't attacked, but spring was coming at last and coming fast. Through March, it was an unusual mottled mess. Temperatures were exceptionally mild. Then across the continent, primroses were out, fruit trees were budding, crocuses teeming. As early as April 3rd, Sir Alexander Cadogan, a British diplomat with a green thumb, noted in his diary, "The herbaceous plants seem all alive, oh, and meadows are greening up nicely and copses purpling." So the point is, what was happening is people were thinking, wow, this is a great time of peace. There is this great spring. They were actually being really lulled into a, you know, it's kind of like they were lulled into sleep that, like, well, if the world is so beautiful, there's not going to be any trouble. You know, Hitler's not going to do any attacking. And then what happened is, you know, he moved, you know, on Denmark and Norway. And then what really set things off in May, he attacked and went against Belgium and the Netherlands. And this was getting pretty close to France, but it was also putting Britain in danger. Now, it was a tragedy, but they were all lulled to sleep. And so essentially what happened is Neville Chamberlain was then forced to resign, and then they needed a new prime minister that could really get things going. Here's what Manchester writes on page 47. It says, on Thursday morning, May 9th, the 250th day of the war, Chamberlain faced the bitter truth. He was through. The debacle in Norway had finished him. It had become obvious that Britain needed an all-party national government, and Labour refused to serve under him. Given the huge Tory majority in the House, a legacy of the general election of 1935, the new prime minister would have to be a conservative. The party's leadership wanted Lord Halifax, the foreign secretary. So did Chamberlain, so did the King. However, Tory backbenders and Labour MPs leaned toward the first Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. Halifax bowed out. Telephoning London from his battalion, Randolph Churchill asked for news. His father told him, I think I shall be prime minister tomorrow. And so it was right then that Winston Churchill was back in. And it was really the government, it was really deeply pessimistic at the time. You know, the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, King George VI, were convinced that Britain could not win the war against Germany. David Lloyd George, who had been Prime Minister during World War I, he believed the same thing. Other leading figures, such as the press, this Lord Beaverbrook, they shared the view. They knew they couldn't win the war without a really good leader. They believed that Britain had to take this negotiated peace with Europe. I mean, that's what they thought. Germany would dominate the continent of Europe. Britain would retain its empire. That's what they thought they would get from Hitler. Now, obviously, Hitler, of course, would say he was in favor of such a treaty. But the thing is, Churchill was just incensed with that thought. And, he really worked very hard to rally the nation to fight, to get up and fight, and not, you know, don't be so fooled and let someone like Hitler, you know, lull you into, you know, a belief that he's going to be peaceful and let you retain your empire. He wasn't going to do that at all. Here's what Manchester says on page 49, and these are some details, like I said, that aren't covered in Paul Johnson. He says the upcoming Sunday was Whitsuntide, traditionally part of a long holiday weekend for Englishmen, and celebrated by Christians as the day the Holy Spirit descended upon Christ's disciples. Londoners were impressed when, on Friday, having learned the attack upon the Low Countries, their government canceled the bank holiday. It meant, wrote Molly Panther Downs for the New Yorker, the government is really getting a move on. No reliable news was coming out of the Low Countries, and that was bad. Yet Britons were calm. No excited crowds took to the streets. Panther Downs wrote, it takes a good, stiff dose of adversity to release the formidable strength in what Harold Nicholson calls the slow-grinding willpower of the British people. To that has been added the quickening realization they are fighting for their lives. Now, Manchester continues, for almost a decade, Churchill had been drumming warnings to his countrymen that this day would come. 300 years earlier, during the English Civil War, both the Royalists and the Parliamentary armies introduced drummers into their ranks. They went into the battle unarmed and beat out coded orders which could be heard over the crash of muskets and cannon. Form up, face right, left, volley. The drummers were not meant to inspire or comfort their comrades or to introduce confusion and fear into the enemy ranks, yet with the blinding, stinking smoke and the bloody mayhem of combat, their relentless rhythmic tap and thrum did just that. Where the drummers of England went, empire followed. Rudyard Kipling glorified them in the drums of the fore and aft, which in the courage of two young regimental drummers inspired the regiment, which on the verge of annihilation and the hands of Afghan tribesmen regroup, attacks, and at the end of the slaughter claim victory. Churchill's heroes, Pitt, Marlborough, Nelson, had not only led, they had inspired. Winston Churchill was prepared now to step forward as England's master and commander and its drummer. But were his king and countrymen ready for him? Would Britons join with him when he arrived and fight alongside him to the end? Were they prepared, each and all, to die in defense of family, home, king, and country? Churchill was. He had readied himself for this moment during every hour of every day for six decades when he first sent his toy armies charging across the floors of his father's London townhouse. And so here, the thing is, what they really began to understand is that they needed Churchill. And Churchill was then made prime minister on May 10th, 1940. And what he did was what they needed done, is he formed a coalition government, including representatives of all major parties. There was Labour, Liberal, and Conservative. Churchill assumed the position of Minister for Defense. this was a unique situation. He said he combined the offices of Prime Minister and Minister for Defense. What it did is enabled him to coordinate both the political and the military efforts. He called for victory. Anything less, he warned, would spell the end of the British Empire. And essentially, the King of Belgium had surrendered. There was a large number of British troops and French troops cut off at Dunkirk. And that's where we're all leading to. And so we don't want to get into that just yet. But it's amazing. I want to read again from Manchester here about how Winston Churchill then eventually it was decided. And it took Hitler going into the Low Countries. I mean, that really brought him very close to Britain. This is on page 51. It says, shortly after tea on Friday, May 10th, 15 hours after Hitler drove his steel into the Low Countries, Neville Chamberlain reluctantly returned the seals of his office to King George VI, who received them with equal reluctance. I accepted his resignation, the sovereign wrote in his diary that evening, and told him how grossly unfairly I thought he had been treated. Shortly after 6 o'clock, the king anointed as prime minister the massive, stooped, 65-year-old First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill. Later, King George became one of Churchill's most ardent admirers, but his feelings were mixed at the time. In his diary that day, Jock Colville wrote that the king, remembering perhaps the abdication which Churchill had opposed, is understood not to wish to send for Winston. Nevertheless, an all-party government was essential, and Labour had been adamant they would not serve under Chamberlain. Defending Britain and her empire would be the new prime minister's responsibility for the next 5 years, or until he was hurled from office by Parliament or Hitler. Yet as he rode back from Buckingham Palace, neither he nor anyone else in London felt unduly alarmed over the course of the war. Little was known that evening about the day's developments across the Channel. The Luftwaffe had bombed airfields in Belgium and Holland. Parachute troops had landed among the Belgians, who were said to be fighting well. Dutch resistance was reportedly stubborn, and the Allies were taking up strong positions on the Antwerp-Namur line, preparing to defend the Albert Canal. Everything was going as expected, or so it seemed at that hour. When the BBC announced Churchill's appointment that night, his daughter Mary, 17, listened to the broadcast in the small cottage at Chartwell where her governess lived. When it was finished, she switched off the wireless and said a prayer for her father. Churchill was surrounded by his family, whether at Number 10 or in the underground annex. Of the older Churchill children, only Sarah, the actress, was still a civilian, living with her husband in a Westminster Gardens flat. And soon she, too, would be commissioned in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Sarah's husband, Vic Oliver, Austrian by birth, the son of Baron Victor Oliver von Samick, had renounced his barony, changed the K in Victor to a C, and was now an American citizen. Churchill, upon first meeting Oliver in 1936, took an immediate dislike to the man, and a letter to Clementine cut loose. Oliver was as common as dirt, possessed a horrible mouth, and spoke with an Austro-Yankee drawl. Yet no mention was made of the one trait which many of the English aristocracy would have found sufficient to dismiss Vic Oliver outright. His family was Jewish. It would not have occurred to Churchill to do so. He measured the man. Of the other children, Diana and Randolph were already officers, she in the Women's Royal Navy Service, Randolph in his father's old regiment, the 4th Hussars. Mary worked in a canteen for the Red Cross and lived with her parents. So did Randolph's 20-year-old wife, Pamela, who was expecting their first child in October. When the air raids began with June's full moon, Pamela and her father-in-law shared bunk beds in the basement of Number 10 because she was pregnant. Hers was the bottom bunk, and the early hours of each morning she awoke to hear Churchill laboriously climb the short ladder to his Clementine slept in another basement bedroom. And so the point I wanted to make with that quote is the whole Churchill family got behind their father, and they were really supportive of him being prime minister. Well, that's all we have for today's program. Next time, we will begin our discussion of the miracle of Dunkirk, and the 60-plus panel will be back with me at that time. The next book in this series is also by Paul Johnson. It's titled George Washington, Founding Father. And our third book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can find both books on Amazon. You can find used copies of the books at abebooks.com. And of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.